folks, you've heard me say this forever. Partnerships are like marriages, but they're harder to get out of, you know? So anyone who's going to sign on your deal or anything like that, you definitely have to kind of get that relationship there. But it sounds like, you know, what these guys are doing is saying, hey, we've got a few trusted players who are, you know, probably good people. They're not equity sharks. They're not going to try to force you out of the deal. You know, otherwise if they did, you're not going to have clients for very long. So, you know, they're incentivized to take care of you and make sure you turn out right with your deal. But, you know, sometimes that's all, and it's so backwards in this world. I experienced this years ago when I got started. It's like, okay, well, you know, look, I've got the good credit, financial acumen. You know, I've got the pro forma experience. I've got construction experience. Like, I can do this, you know? And then I walk into the bank and they said, well, you haven't done this before. Like, well, doesn't everyone have a first time?
A lot of times folks struggle to even get into deals. You know, we can't get you a loan until you've actually got into the project. So that's one thing we do. The other thing we do is that we found that as people try to do larger deals, the bank then says, listen, we need to see someone on the hook who has a net worth and the liquidity of X and Y. And again, if John is doing $1 or $2 million deals and suddenly he wants to pursue that $5-10 million deal, he may not have the net worth and liquidity the bank will require to get comfortable with it. Well, we'll bring a partner to that venture that will act as a passive partner in the deal and provide the strength of their personal balance sheet to the venture in order to help get the lender comfortable. So we do things like that to kind of plug those little gaps that help professionalize and, you know, that smaller demographic so that they don't look like that high risk, you know, individual that we just discussed.
You're listening to the Real Estate Runway podcast powered by Quattro Capital, where we're all about alternative business and investment strategies to help you amplify life and maximize wealth. Here's your host, Chad, the investment maverick.
All right. Real Estate Runway. Welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Runway podcast. Good to see you, family. I have a very exciting episode, and this one might be a record. I think Vernon and I rescheduled this episode 7 times before finally doing it. So this is the life of busy professionals and doing this on the side, but it's a lot of fun. I'm glad to bring it to you. So Vernon is the co-founder of Diversified Lending Solutions, and I'm so excited for what we're going to get into today, because for those of you who are looking at acquiring smaller asset types, like, and I'm saying like, you know, 20, 30 unit apartment buildings or smaller than that, or even, you know, maybe even a little bit bigger, these guys have a really cool platform and some cool alternative lending solutions, creative lending solutions that we're going to get to use. So Vernon, welcome to the show. How are you today, brother?
Chad, thank you for having me. So happy to be here. I know it took a little while, but better late than never. So glad to be here.
Yep. I never look back to see who rescheduled. It may have been me. So I'm not going to be. We're seeing a theme there. And I actually got through that intro without coughing. I had a tickle in my throat. And if you're on video, you probably just saw me go on mute really quickly and cough. So we're good. But it's not in the audio. So Vernon, let's get right into it. I want to hear about you. So you chose to walk a very different path in the lending world. You know, tell me what makes you who you are today. What got you into the desire to create diversified lending solutions? Now, what was the problem you were trying to solve?
Sure, absolutely. So my background, like a lot of folks, when I came out of college, started in Wall Street. Everyone wanted to be a big, you know, investment banker with the pinstripe suit on. And that was my first exposure to real estate. And I got the opportunity to help finance very large transactions and understand basically the meat and potatoes of how deals get capitalized. What I discovered very quickly, though, when I went and tried to do small deals with my friends, was that it was an infinitely different world when you were trying to put together a $1 million deal versus going out and financing a $100 million deal. Whether or not the people were smart, whether or not they had the qualifications, whether or not the asset was in a good location, it started to feel like it was this Herculean task, and it really frustrated me. So I'm living two lives, one working on Wall Street on these, you know, big transactions, the other one trying to get deals done with my friends, and constantly would see, okay, there's an inefficiency in the small investment segment that needs to be addressed. Didn't do anything about it until years later when I ultimately decided to start DLS and say, listen, it's time now that I've been in, you know, the institutional space long enough that I can help bring some of that white glove institutional expertise for folks that are earlier in their journey and trying to build to become the next big company. But they aren't there yet. They don't have institutional relationships, and they need to fill the gaps on how to figure out how to do it. So that's why we launched Diversified Lending Solutions.
I love that. And it's definitely a niche. And coming from someone who I have done $40 million deals and I have done $2 million deals and lower, right? I think I even, the lowest one I have done, at least in the apartment space, was exactly $1 million deal. And I will tell you, and I have theories on why, so I'm going to say my theory and I want to hear your take on it. I have theories on why finding lenders for that smaller deal. So for example, $1 million deal, I think I got a $750,000 loan, 75%, right? Which was aggressive. Then I turn around and do a $10 million deal and I've got lenders lined up to wanting me to use their money, right? Now this is, you know, 5 years ago, but the point is my thought on why this is, it seems like the failure rate on smaller borrowers is probably higher. For example, if you have the wherewithal to go get a $7 million loan, you're probably pretty financially savvy and have some good credit and all that. And whereas if you're kind of stretching to get to a $750,000 loan, maybe you're younger in business, or maybe you're just not quite as, you don't have that bankable wherewithal. So that was kind of my thought, is maybe the failure rate is higher, but the other is, it takes just as, and I know this just from the deal side, it takes just as much work to get a $10 million deal done as it does to get a $1 million deal done, for the most part. Some things are different.
Ding, ding, ding.
So man, maybe that's it. So it's like, yeah, I don't, a lot of lenders just don't get out of bed for less than $5 million, you know, on a loan. So, exactly. I mean, what are your thoughts on why this void exists, you know?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. I think, A, there is, all things being equal, more experience is better, right? If I'm going to be a lender, and my upside is capped because I'm making an interest in rate, my downside is unlimited because maybe you won't pay me back. And so I'm incentivized, right, to pine the people that are the most qualified to execute on what they say they're going to execute on. Now, the problem is that there are plenty of highly qualified individuals early in their career. And so the question is, can I distinguish, if I'm a lender, which ones are the good ones or the bad ones? And to your second point, sometimes the juice just isn't worth the squeeze, because if I have to really kind of squinch to distinguish the good guy from the not so good guy, and I'm going to put out a couple $1 million, or I could go out and put 30, 40, 50 million with someone that at least on paper looks like they know what they're doing. It doesn't mean that they do, but at least they've gotten this far along in their journey that they can kind of prove that they kind of do. Well, then I'm going to cover my butt and go with that other option. And so I think that happens, and where that actually, and on some level that makes sense, but I think where that's problematic is that the overwhelming majority of real estate transactions are actually small. I think in our mind, we look outside, right, and we see skyscrapers and we see downtowns and we think the average deal is a $100 million deal, when the average transaction across America is closer to $3 million. And so,
interesting data point. Yeah.
You know, so economically, we're doing ourselves as a disservice to the growth potential when we create natural caps that actually impede people's ability to enter into the market, because the market is by its very nature small. The bigger companies have gotten and the more concentrated they've gotten in providing loans and real estate services means they just need to swing bigger deals in order for them to justify their existence. Whereas 20 years ago, when the industry was more fragmented, more of a cottage industry, there was enough distribution of different companies that some would do the small deals, some would do the medium deals, some would do the large deal. Now we've kind of gravitated to a world where the lion's share of folks trying to focus on the big deals when actually most of the deals are small.
It's very interesting. And it kind of speaks to the movement in the lending market. You know, for example, I remember there was not very many shops, for example, that would do, call it $500,000 to $5 million bridge loans, you know?
Yep.
And I think of the three players that I knew of who could do it and do it well, two of them have been acquired by a big house in the last year. So it's very interesting. Exactly. But Anyway, let's get back to diversified lending solutions. So you found the problem, you identified the void. We've talked about why the void is there, but that doesn't change the fact that the overwhelming majority of transactions that could be done are probably sub $3 million transactions and loans. So, you know, how have you and your team approached filling that void?
Sure. So that's a great question. We've done it a few different ways. One is in our approach towards helping that early stage operator distinguish themselves from the one that isn't qualified, right? If they're qualified, they should get a shot. And so our job is to help differentiate them from the guys that aren't ready yet. And there's a whole process and methodology that we apply to first determining ourselves whether that person fits that mold. And if they do, helping frame their deal, both to their potential debt provider and also their potential equity investors, in a way to maximize their chance of getting capital. So that's number one. Number two is actually providing what I would consider fairly creative, unique products ourselves. So in addition to arranging financing, we will actually provide earnest money deposit loans to our clients. So what does that mean? It means that John is used to buying a $1 million property. He wants to buy a $3 million property, but he realizes when he does that, he's going to have to come up out of pocket for an earnest money deposit. He doesn't want to exhaust all of his personal resources, so maybe he doesn't look at $3 million deals. No reason not to. We'll provide short-term loans to allow him to go to contract to that property and then backfill that capital with his investor capital once he's shown he has the property under contract. And so that, in our mind, is a way for him to get into the deal. A lot of times folks struggle to even get into deals. You know, we can't get you a loan until you've actually got into the project. So that's one thing we do. The other thing we do is that we found that as people try to do larger deals, the bank then says, listen, we need to see someone on the hook who has a net worth and the liquidity of X and Y. And again, if John is doing $1 or $2 million deals and suddenly he wants to pursue that $5, $10 million deal, he may not have the net worth and liquidity the bank will require to get comfortable with it. Well, we'll bring a partner to that venture that will act as a passive partner in the deal and provide the strength of their personal balance sheet to the venture in order to help get the lender comfortable. So we do things like that to kind of plug those little gaps that help professionalize and, you know, that smaller demographic so that they don't look like that high risk, you know, individual that we just discussed.
Yeah, that kind of speaks to the creative nature of your design here. And so, you know, a couple of follow-on thoughts on that. And, you know, folks, you've heard me say this forever. Partnerships are like marriages, but they're harder to get out of, you know. So anyone who's going to sign on your deal or anything like that, you definitely have to kind of get that relationship there. But it sounds like, you know, what these guys are doing is saying, hey, we've got a few trusted players who are, you know, probably good people. They're not equity sharks. They're not going to try to force you out of the deal. You know, otherwise, if they did, you're not going to have clients for very long. So, you know, they're incentivized to take care of you and make sure you turn out right with your deal. But, you know, sometimes that's all, and it's so backwards in this world. I experienced this years ago when I got started. It's like, okay, well, you know, look, I've got the good credit, financial acumen, you know, I've got the pro forma experience, I've got construction experience, like I can do this, you know? And then I walk into the bank and they said, well, you haven't done this before. I'm like, well, doesn't everyone have a first time? Yeah, but that's not our problem. You know, and so you wind up looking for someone. You just have to have someone who's done it before. I mean, even HUD loans are this way. If you want to build on a HUD loan, you just have to have someone who's done one before, someone who puts their hand on your shoulder. And in most cases, that is just a silent, passive partner who will probably take a fee for it. They're probably going to check up on you and make sure you don't run it into the ground because that's their reputation.
Exactly.
You know, but is there anything else that goes into that? You know, like, so for that we'll call it a guarantor relationship. You know, what kind of ongoing relationship is there, you know, and covenants and things of that sort?
Well, you couldn't have been more right in the sense that it is a relationship. You can't just view it as a transaction. This is someone who's putting their personal name on a deal and their personal credibility on the deal, and they haven't gotten there that far without being very mindful of how they protect it. And so one of the things we do up front is just making sure it almost feels like a matchmaking experience in the early stages to make sure, okay, philosophically, do these two people align in how they view the world? Can we be honest and transparent about what you know and what you don't know and where your strengths and weaknesses are? You know, can you give us some understanding of if you've done other deals and they haven't gone well, why? And I find that usually for our relationships, that transparency goes very far in establishing trust. And that's a really big variable up front. You can get paid, you know, up to wazoo, but when it comes to a guarantee, you know, the result is often binary, right? It's like either nothing happens or we found ourselves with a guarantee being called. And that's usually a very, you know, something very bad happened. And so people are trying to figure out, okay, is this someone that A, I trust is going to be a good steward of the capital, but if things get crazy, do I have faith that they're not going to be a complete lunatic and act irresponsibly? And so the biggest process is getting there and getting to, okay, this is someone I can sit down with. What we found is that once that happens, as long as the counterparty is sharing their reporting in a time, you know, effective manner, they're sharing with their partners what's happening, good or bad, you know, in a reasonable cadence. We're not speaking every day on the phone about every little minute detail, but we will have quarterly checkups just to make sure things are going okay. I found that this is not, to your point, folks that want to spend all of their day running the deal. These are folks that have probably already built a good amount of wealth themselves. They like the idea of participating in this fashion in deals with people that are coming up and frankly doing all the heavy lifting. And as long as they're being kept, you know, abreast of what's going on, usually they're very comfortable taking a passive seat.
Yeah, and I don't want to belabor this, folks, but I kind of feel like this is important because I've been on both sides of this table where it's like, hey, I'm kind of putting my hand on someone's shoulder, and I've also had someone's hand on my shoulder. And if you're into YouTube motivation at all, you guys listen to me enough, you know I'm a big mindset and motivation guy. It's so important, power of the subconscious mind. But if you just Google a guy named Jocko Willink, he's an ex Navy SEAL, like this bad dude, right? Great dude, but just, you know, looks ridiculous. But, you know, he's got a video out there called Be a Pro. And what he says is he had the fortune to come up under this one dude who was another SEAL who taught him so much. And they had a motivational speech one day, and he just looked at him and he said, you know what, in everything you do, be a pro. You know, when you walk into a room, be like the people in that room say, that's exactly what I thought that would look like. You know, like everything is tight. Everything is in place. Like, you know, the guy just has the composure, you know, be a pro. And so that's the same kind of thing that I want you all to bring to this here is, you know, if you work with a group like Vernon's here, and especially if you get someone who is accomplished to say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to back this person, right? Show that person that you're a pro. Show that person that you're ready to play at that level. You know, get your reporting in on time. You know, just do everything you're supposed to do and outshine that. And you just said the word relationship. Relationship and reputation are all you have in this world. And if you do that right once, you probably have a person who can help you grow.
Exactly. Couldn't say it better. And I find that some folks, even if they're well-intentioned, sometimes they take shortcuts, not because they're bad people, but because circumstances will always create stress, and sometimes people, you know, make short-sighted calls. I would say, you know, relationships are long-term, and it's very, very hard to repair a broken relationship. So do the upfront legwork just to make sure that people are exceedingly happy with, if nothing else, the amount of attention and diligence you give to being professional and being transparent. That doesn't mean everything will always go well, and I don't think people necessarily expect that, but they just expect that there's someone responsible on the other side who's actually going to respect their time, respect, you know, their participation in the deal. And if they can show that through those, you know, those gestures that you mentioned, I think it's priceless in terms of your ability to build relationships down the road, because that person will then refer you. That person will then put his hand back on your shoulder when you need it again, maybe even more so than they did the first time. So it's a long game here.
And just like I said, folks, relationship and reputation are all you have in this world. Your reputation is built on your ability to develop multiple relationships that are good, right? And so you wind up with a good reputation for that. And a relationship is nothing more than the know, like, and trust factor. First, they have to know you, then they grow to like you, and then they learn to trust you. And you break any one of those three things, it's hard to repair that relationship. So that's the mechanics around what Vernon is saying here. So let's get back into the meat here a little bit. So, you know, diversified lending solutions. So what types of loan products? So we've talked about, you know, helping get the wherewithal in place to do a bigger loan as you're trying to grow in real estate. What types of loan products do y'all specialize in? And so like the, when I think about a lending or a capital markets player, because I think you're not just lending your capital markets, you know, there might be equity placement services like both pref and common. There might be, you know, short-term bridge lending solutions. There might be hard money solutions. There might be the ability to go originate a GSE or an agency loan, you know? Mm-hmm. So like what kind of tools have y'all put together and decided, this is the best type of money available for these smaller real estate projects?
Sure. So, we will cover all major property types, and we'll cover projects from ground up construction up through stabilized cash flow. So what that means is that we have to be nimble in terms of the different range of products that we have coverage or visibility to. So it could be construction financing. It could be traditional value add bridge. It could be permanent stabilized cash flow. It could be agency. So the short answer is that we find the deal, we find the sponsor, and then we find the capital that's most efficient based off of their specific business plan. What I would say in today's market is that given where we are in the rate environment, a lot of people are struggling because their senior loan is getting cut much lower than it would have a year and a half ago. So if someone could go out and get maybe 80% financing before, maybe they're closer to 60% today, which means how am I going to plug that hole? Do I need to raise 40% equity? And so what we found is really a lot of folks asking, how do I bridge that gap? Mezzanine debt, preferred equity has kind of been the flavor of the week that everyone's trying to find a solution for in that respect. And so what we've been spending so much of our time recently is either helping operators work to identify and deepen their equity capital sources, or finding replacements or hybrid that look like equity but isn't straight equity, like either pref or mezz.
That makes a lot of sense, and there's just a lot of pieces there, and especially folks, if you haven't spent a lot of time in the capital markets, listen back on any of the like prior 50 episodes that we've done here. There's probably something about what's been going on in the debt markets. There will be. And, you know, simply put, I mean, we rode with artificially low interest rates for so long, you know, eventually we knew they had to come back up. We didn't know that they would quite have to come back up this rapidly, you know, in order to combat the macroeconomic inflation issues, but they did. And so therefore you have, we've been dealing with higher valuations that are kind of, you know, trending with lower interest rates. And we all got used to, you know, being able to get full leverage, and that's, you know, 75% to 80% on properties. Well, it's just not there right now because the cash flow doesn't support the debt service at that leverage. And so that's that you always have to be thinking when you're looking at your deals. It's not just loan to value. And this is a big lesson for those doing smaller properties, because you won't be used to this. You're used to loan to value, right? On your personal home, for example, or a small complex. Loan, you have to be looking at loan to value, and you have to be looking at debt service coverage ratio at the same time. And there's a few other factors, but those two are the primary ones. One is just your total loan amount divided by your price. Obviously, a lender's not going to give you, you know, all of the price in a loan, except for certain stupid low buy situations, right? But where they're looking at after repair value. But you focus on that, but you really have to be watching debt coverage ratio right now. And that is nothing more than the ratio of the cash flow coming off the building in your current or stabilized state, depending what they look at, to the debt service required, you know, how much money you have to pay on that loan at that interest rate in a given year. So most loans right now are what we call debt service constrained. That means that, yeah, they'll give you more leverage if you had the cash flow for it, but you're probably going to get pulled down to 55 or 60% or something like that, depending on how well you're buying it, because of the debt service. So anything to add to that, Vernon?
No, Chad, you're spot on. And one thing I'd add is that for many of the folks that have been enamored with value add multi, going in, buying a multifamily, renovating it, turning it around, stabilizing it, for many of the other folks we're dealing with that were doing that over the last couple of years, they went out and took floating rate debt, right? So that debt moves in concert with an index. And as that index has creeped up, that means those debt service payments that Chad just referred to creep up as well. And many of those folks did not buy interest rate caps, which is an instrument that would allow you to basically hedge the fact that rates could continue going up. And so the cap is meant to ensure that your costs don't exceed a certain amount. For folks that didn't buy a cap or something comparable to a cap, they found themselves really, really constrained, where maybe their property isn't even cash flow positive and they're coming out of pocket or going to their investors and saying, we need to raise fresh capital either to fund the cap or to fund these shortfalls. And so what we're seeing also for the folks that are opportunistic in the world right now, there are many operators that are, you know, holding on by a thread on their properties. They've managed to maybe negotiate a little bit extra time with their lenders, but there's more pain in the market than is actually being broadcast by what you may see driving down the street. So I would say if you're someone who's looking to be opportunistic in buying real estate, there is going to be some opportunity as a result of that stress.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And folks, I say this all the time. You have two parts of any working business, right? And a real estate asset is a working business. You have a product you're selling. You just happen to have a building that everybody lives in, right? But you have to have cash flow, because without cash flow and positive cash flow, that is, you will eventually run out of money. And how long it takes you to run out of money is based on how much cash you have in the bank. So said a very simple way, if I have a building that is cash flowing negatively, I'm losing $10 a month, right? And I have $100 in the bank, it's going to take me 10 months until I run out of money, until I'm bankrupt, right? At which point you have the opportunity to go and borrow some more money, get some more investment money, or put some more of your own money in and reset the clock. But that is, and so that's a great way to illustrate the pain that has come up is if you didn't make good loan decisions, it's not over, and you learn from your mistakes. You know, an interest rate hedges is an important thing if you're going to float the rate, and that it's just like an insurance policy to make sure your rate doesn't go over X. But if you didn't, you can still put it in place. But you definitely want to be looking for these opportunities, because in some cases there are folks who have been bleeding for a very long time. And I'll tell you, back in 2022, when this started, before we started hiking rates, the floating rate index was at 0.3, effectively zero. Okay. And maybe the lender said, okay, I'm going to give you a loan at 3% over that index. Well, okay, my loan's now 3.3%. Great. This is awesome. I'm going to hurry and renovate all the properties. And to do that, I got to destabilize it and lower the income for a time, and then I'll bring it back. It's great. Well, then in a 12-month period, you go from 0.3 to 5.5% on that index. Well, guess what? If you're at 3% over your index, you're now paying 8.5%. And that's that, folks. I mean, do the percentage difference on that. It's huge. That is the difference between something that cash flows moderately well to something that is losing you money every single month. So let's talk to those people right now. If you're on this show and you perhaps did your first deal or an early deal in that time, and you're feeling the pain of, oh my God, my cash flow is negative, my interest rate changed, like all these things you just didn't know you didn't know. You know, what options do y'all have where you may be able to help them look at, okay, let's go solve for this problem. Maybe it's a rate cap. Maybe it's new equity. You know, like how would you approach solving that problem today for someone who's in that position?
Sure. So it's a combination of all the things you mentioned. So first of all, I would say you want to be in a position to understand what your lender would be willing to accept as far as a short to intermediate resolution to the scenario. Best of all scenarios, you're paying out of pocket, like you said, you had $10 in the bank. You're just willfully putting in 10, 10, 10. Well, many of the operators say at some point, well, I'm not going to just keep putting in 10, 10, 10 because I see, you know, I have 10 months of this stuff and I see where the future holds. So they go to their lender and say, listen, you see that I'm coming out of pocket for this thing. I can't do this indefinitely. So we're going to have to come to some sort of arrangement. I don't want to sell the property right now. You don't want me to sell the property right now because, frankly, the value is impaired relative to when I owned it a year ago. So let's work something out that will allow for sufficient time for us to both exit this situation under better terms. And whether that be a loan extension or a modification, the first piece is understanding, you know, what would that lender be willing to deal with? And unfortunately, I went through the GFC and I worked for one of the companies that had to negotiate distress situations on behalf of investors. So for better or worse, I think a lot of the folks that have come through this generation of multifamily may not have been through the GFC. And so that process of speaking to a lender, negotiating a modification may feel new, may feel uncomfortable. You may want to put your head under the sand. That's a big piece of the puzzle. Second piece of that puzzle is invariably the lender may say, well, bring fresh equity to the table. You know, pay my loan down some, fund an interest reserve, buy a cap, do something. I'm not just going to give you a free option to have more time. And so in that case, it's going to be two sources generally of fresh capital. One is your current investor base, which may or may not have an appetite to put more money into a deal if they're already seeing that their first, you know, round of investment has not gone particularly well. And then there's a second fresh source of capital, which we would potentially bring to the table, which could help effectuate that extension, that modification, and buy more time. What I've said is that the biggest challenge in structuring those deals is usually a disagreement as to where the asset is valued today. And I'm thinking, finally, there seems to be some mutual agreement. The values have come down, and this is where they sit. For the last year, there was more or less operators holding on to hope that rates would come down really fast, or fast enough at least to justify that, no, the value didn't fall as much as everyone said it would. Now that people have come to the reality that rates are higher for longer than they want them to be, there's gradually been an acceptance that, okay, in order for me to move forward, I'm going to have to accept that we're going to have to remark the value of the asset, which is can be painful, obviously, because it usually results in a markdown to the current investors in the deal. But if that keeps you alive for long enough to actually ultimately recover your investment, it may be what you need to do. So, you know, working with us is really having the tough conversation of figuring out what your options are and what we can do, you know, to buy more time. That is, if you decide you don't want to sell the asset today.
Yeah. And folks, just to decode a couple things there, GFC, global financial crisis, 2008, like all that stuff that happened back then, great recession. Like you've heard it called a lot of things. If GFC didn't resonate with you, that's what he's talking about there. So like, I think the biggest thing that Vernon just said is when you have a loan, especially when it's not going well, it feels like it's law and it's against you. Right. But it is always a negotiation. And what my experience has been 100% of the time is a lender just wants their money back. That's it. They just want to get repaid. That's the reason they're doing loans and not equity deals, is they just want to put money out, have it secured by real estate. And that's why they lend, you know, for example, 70% of value, because they like, okay, well, the market has to drop. The value has to drop 30% for at least me to not get my money back. Right. And they don't care about you. But, you know, that's why they're taking such a low percentage. And so the important thing is to, just as Vernon said, you know, use Vernon's company, Diversified Lending Solutions, use me, like anyone who's got this experience, just bounce ideas, know that you can negotiate, know that maturity dates are typically not hard dates. Like a lot of times I've had a lender walk me right up to maturity saying they're not going to negotiate just to see if I'd pay the loan off. And then the day after, we started having conversation and we got it done, you know, so it's just like, it's just a game of chicken and it sucks, you know, but know you have options, know there is money out there who can help you get there. And I know, like, for those of you who have taken investors for the first time, communicate with them. Let them know where you are. They are under no illusion, most of them, that things are always going to go well all the time, but they are looking to how you react. The more you communicate, the more you stay ahead of it, the more proactive you are, the better you're going to look in their eyes. And even if it comes down to just recovering their initial investment with no return on top of it, that is still a win today, right?
So absolutely.
If you're in that position, that is not a bad outcome, and they will respect you for that.
I mean, people will not only respect you, they may take you out for a steak dinner, because if we think about how much values have come down, I mean, multifamily, let's just say, is down, let's just call it 30%. This is a
33% right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if somebody actually said, wow, I actually got a recovery, or even a modest, you know, a small haircut on what I put in, they're probably celebrating in today's market.
Yeah, unless they live under a rock and have no idea what's been going on. So
exactly.
Anyway, Vernon, let's get to these questions real quick, and then I want to give you a chance to let them know how to reach out to you. So First Quattro question, what is your superpower, life or business, and, you know, how do you serve others with it?
So my superpower, you know, it's funny. I go back and forth. I always ask my wife, you know, because she has a knack for telling me. And I'm like, oh, you know, that's true. But for me, it's always been, I'm deeply intellectually curious. And what that translates into is really having an authentic and genuine curiosity around the people that I interact with, which translates into me being able to have really, really strong working relationships with people. And people wanting to actually find ways to work. I find that there are a lot of really smart, talented folks that struggle to attract and work with other people. And I find that, you know, I worked in Japan, I worked in New York City, I've been in, you know, Baltimore. So the adaptability is largely my ability to find something interesting and curious to learn about everyone that I work with and encounter. And so I think that's my superpower.
That's incredible, Vernon. And so flip the coin over for me. What is your biggest failure or mistake, again, life or business? And most importantly, what did you take away from
it? Yeah, so I'm glad you said flip the coin, because for me, sometimes being intellectually curious can also lead me to a point of rumination or overthinking or overanalyzing. And I found that I had to train my mind and train myself to say, okay, what information do I need to actually make a decision and not be stalled or caught into the analysis paralysis loop where you're so interested in learning everything you need to learn to make the decision that you never make the decision. And that, by the way, was not helped by the fact that I was a lender in Wall Street. So lenders are by their very nature people that are risk averse. So I really have, over the last, I would say, 10 years, really worked deliberately on being able to act with very strong conviction in the absence of perfect information.
That's incredible. Yeah. And you know, your greatest strength can also be your greatest weakness at times. So that's
absolutely,
it's good perspective. All right. So let's hop over to, I want to address two things with the shameless plug session, right? I want to hear about this publication that you have coming out that you and I were talking about and where the listeners can find that. And I want you to talk about how can they get in touch with you and have, you know, get support from Diversified Lending Solutions.
Excellent. So I'm so excited that you brought this up, because this is like my baby right now. But one of the things that I was really frustrated with when I would read real estate publications is that I find more and more, in the same way that the industry is migrating to the really big companies, so is the news. And so every time I'm reading an article about, you know, the billion-dollar fund doing XYZ, I'm saying, well, what about that, you know, guy or female that went out and did their first multifamily, or they did their first 200-unit acquisition? And, like, people should be in their local community, like, throwing a parade, because this is awesome and this is an engine of local economic growth and this is an entrepreneur doing something amazing. I just don't think that there's enough representation of that. And I also don't think that there's enough in the way of resources around, well, how do you bridge the gap for those folks? They're clearly trying to figure it out as they go along. Maybe they have a great mastermind group. Maybe they have a great mentor, or maybe they're just learning by trial and error, which I think a lot of people end up doing. And I said,
"Scars and Stripes method is what that's called, by the way."
Well, it sounds a lot more glamorous than it is, you know. But so I say, there's got to be more. In the same way that Bigger Pockets has done that very well in some of the residential stuff for folks, I said, for folks that are also doing multi-industrial, mixed use, adaptive reuse, there's just got to be more tools out there that they can share information. So we're in the process of launching a publication. It's called Emerge, and the name is not accidental. It's really focused on, I would say, small, emerging, and diverse operators as well, because what we found is that there's been so many folks from different groups, whether it be people of color, whether it be veterans, that even more so than just the general public have disproportionately lacked access to the information and tools to figure out how to advance themselves. So we will be launching the publication later this month. It is www.emerge-re.com. But keep an eye out for that and check us out. And frankly, if you're a young or not young, but just young in your journey, entrepreneur, developer, operator that has a great story, we'd love to cover it. We'd love to share it. And if there's something that you've learned on your deal that you can impart with others, we would love for that message to get spread.
That's incredible. And folks, if you're driving, if you're watching, our amazing podcast manager, Kyle, is going to make sure that that link is in the show notes. So just scroll right down. It'll be right there for your clicking pleasure. And to follow on with that, how do we best have people get in touch with you should they want to talk about capital markets, loans, rescue capital if they're in that situation? Or just, you know, it sounds like just having a strategy call is probably a good idea to kind of get your head on straight. You know, how does that work?
Absolutely. They can visit us at www.dlsloans.com. They can find us there. I'm also on LinkedIn, very active. So feel free to DM me directly, Vernon Beckford on LinkedIn.
Good deal. I just connected with him right now. So I can see he's very active on LinkedIn. Last question, and then we got to bring this one to a close. I know Vernon's a busy man. At Quattro, we are very big on philanthropy, doing good in the world while we do well. You know, we have four pillars. They are people, property, profits, and philanthropy. That is a group of people coming together around property to make a profit, some of which we use for philanthropy, coming right back and taking care of people. So I love to give our guests an opportunity to share their heart, how you give your time, your talents, your treasures, you know, whatever you do to improve and do good in the world. And I'd venture to say your business is part of that. But what is that for you?
Yeah, that's such an important question. So one of the biggest frustrations for me and my business partner over the last few years is that there are oftentimes really high potential individuals or companies that we simply don't have the resources to help because they don't have a budget. They're still too early on in their progression. And so we're in the process of launching a nonprofit entity that would exist specifically to support those folks and provide resources for those folks that are just starting out, don't have a massive team to help with all their underwriting and all of their fundraising and all of their negotiations, and to be able to provide that on a subsidized basis to folks so that they actually can have, with confidence, the team that will help them actually close on, if not their first deal, their second, third, or fourth. And so for us, that's a way to supplement what we already do with DLS, but be able to widen the universe of folks that we can work with. And we're really going to dig deep on diverse populations, whether that be people of color, whether that be women-owned enterprises, whether that be veteran-owned enterprises, to really ensure that those demographics get fair and reasonable coverage and exposure that they deserve by virtue of the tools that we can provide. So that is, again, something that I'm very excited about. The entity is called Diversified Community Impact. And so hopefully in the next several months, you'll have me back and I can talk to you about all the exciting things we're doing on that.
Man, have your people call my people. Let's get it scheduled. Let's get you back on. That's an exciting one. And I'm excited to hear about that. So wow, Vernon, action-packed episode. Thank you for coming on, talking about your creative, you know, solutions to really fill a void in the lending market and the smaller cap loans. And so, folks, I'm telling you, reach out. I don't have people on this show that I don't believe in. And so, you know, please do that. and scroll down to the notes for your clicking pleasure. Vernon, we'll have you back on the show in a couple of months. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Chad.
All right, everyone. This has been another episode of the Real Estate Runway Podcast, Lending Edition. Until next time, over and out.
We hope this episode was insightful and brought value to your day. If so, please be awesome and leave us a 5-star review. Find out how Team Quattro can help you at thequattroway.com and scroll down for more info. Until next time, this is the Real Estate Runway Podcast.